Parsha Vayishlach begins the meeting between Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov has a message for Esav. It's short, but it contains a lot. And let us take a look and spend a few moments considering the opening words of Yaakov's message. And this is in Perek Lamed Beis. Okay, by Yishlach Yaakov Malachim, Yaakov has sent angels, messengers, whatever they are, by Yitzavu, something more. He commands them to say, Kotomrun Laduni LeEsav, say the following to my master Esav. Ko Amar Avdecha Yaakov, so says your servant Yaakov, Im Lavan Garti, I have sojourned with Lavan, Va'echar Ad Ata, and I have tarried until now. And Rashi has quite a bit to say, as we know, on the words Im Lavan Garti. I think Rashi's second perush is probably more familiar, but his first perush is Aderech HaPshat. What does Garti mean? Says Rashi, Lo Na'aseisi Sar V'Chashuv. I never became a prominent or important person over there in Haran. Elager, I was only ever really looked upon as a stranger, an alien. So, does he wish to elicit Esav's sympathies? What he means to say is, Ein chakadai lisnoosi. Therefore, it transpires that you don't need to hate me, al birchas avicha, over the brachas of your father, of our father, Yitzchak, Sheberchani hevi givir la'achecha. His bracha to me was hevi givir la'achecha, that I should be a givir to my relatives. La'achecha, the plural is interesting. Not la'achicha, he only has one brother. But la'achecha in the plural, because otherwise, the fact that he didn't become mayor of Haran doesn't say anything about his relationship with Esav. But hevi givir la'achecha in the plural means all your relatives. Lavan is his relative. But even so, he never achieved prominence there. Shaharelo Niskaimabi, that bracha was not fulfilled. What is the background of Rashi's comment? After all, the pasuk seems relatively straightforward. I've lived with Lavan, I've sojourned with Lavan. Why would Rashi feel necessary to provide any comment? And specifically the comment that he does. But of course, the background is that in Lashon HaKodesh, the concept of lagur always has a temporary connotation. That is as opposed to lasheves. Lasheves is to dwell for a significant amount of time. And that is something which is lost on us, I think. It's one of those things where one has to be careful. It's a great bracha to be able to speak Hebrew, but the connotations are different in modern Hebrew than in Lashon HaKodesh, as it originally is, so certain nuances can be lost on us. That's why when you speak Hebrew today, you really need to fulfill two mitzvahs. Firstly, the mitzvah of speaking Hebrew, and secondly, the mitzvah of Havdalah, La'avdil bein Kodesh L'chol, to know the connotation of these words in Lashon HaKodesh, and somehow something's got lost in translation, even from one language to the same language. Because we never use the term Yoshev. A person would say, Ani Yoshev b'Yerushalayim chamishim shana. So that would sound like he's been sitting in the same place in Jerusalem for the last 50 years. And wouldn't help anyone. So as long as a person is there, we always say Ani Gar, even though the noun, interestingly, is Toshav, a resident. But the verb is always lagur, and therefore, for us, it wouldn't make a difference. Garti, absolutely. But the truth is, if you were there for 20 years, 20 years is a long time. That's not called lagur, that's called lashevet. And that's why Rashi feels that one needs to respond to the expression of Garti. And what is the response? The point is, says Rashi, perhaps time-wise he was there for a long time, but impact-wise, prominence-wise, perhaps Garti doesn't mean temporary, but it means transient, in the sense that he was always a lightweight figure over there. Lo nasesi sar v'chashuv. Okay, that's the first perush of Garti. And then, Dovar Acher, of course, you can't keep a gematria down. Dovar Acher, Garti be gematria Taryag. So Garti has the same numerical value and indeed in the same letters as Taryag, Kelomar, as if to say, famous comment of Rashi, Im Lovan Harasha Garti, I lived with love on the wicked, the Tariq mitzvah shemarti, but I was still keeping Tariq mitzvahs. How is Yaakov keeping Tariq mitzvahs with Lavan? Many mitzvahs that are not applicable on a practical scale, but nonetheless, in whatever way possible and to whatever degree possible, in principle, Tariq mitzvahs shemarti. V'lo lamadati mi ma'asav hara'im. I didn't learn from his evil ways. I've been keeping Tariq, or as they say in the colloquial, I've been holding. I'm with the Tariq mitzvahs. Now, what's very interesting, of course, that's a kind of a more drash explanation of the word garti. If you said yashavti, so you miss Taryag. But if you say garti, so you have Taryag. But what's interesting to consider about these two perushim of Rashi is not only that they are very different types of perushim, one seems to be pshat and the other seems to be drash, but they actually appear to be contradictory to each other. Because the question is, what exactly is the measure of the message, or then the nature of the message, the cadence and the tone that Yaakov is wishing to convey to Esav? What does he mean to communicate to him? The first perush of Rashi seems to be very conciliatory in nature, as if to say, I know you're upset with me, please don't be upset with me, nothing came of the brachas, as far as we can tell, I was said, gever gever lachecha, I never became a gever, and therefore perhaps the anger was not warranted. It's very, very, as we say, looking to make the peace. The second perush, Tariq mitzvah shemarti, why does he wish to tell Esav that he's been keeping the Tariq mitzvahs? Presumably that Esav should know with whom he's dealing. But that's altogether a somewhat more aggressive message. It's not that Esav should be concerned about Yaakov's Yiddishkeit, but the point is, Esav should be concerned for himself. I have many merits. I've been keeping Tariq mitzvahs under the most difficult and trying of circumstances. So be careful before you think about going to war or such like. So now these two messages, one's a message of peace and the other is almost like a threatening type of message. The first one seems to be, don't be angry at me. And the second one seems to be, don't mess with me. So how are these two to be reconciled? The truth of the matter is, the Levush HaOra, one of the classic commentaries on Rashi, the Baal HaLevushim, he's famous for many, Levushim of Mordechai Yaffa, Talmud of the Ramah, says that there's no contradiction between these two comments. Because sometimes you need to present a blended message. You need to communicate both sides of the equation. As if to say, there's no question, and I think it works out very well for us, that the pshat is peaceful. And that means that the primary intention is to make the peace. But there's a drash undertone. And it's very important. Because what Yaakov is saying is, you should know, first and foremost, what I want is to make the peace. But you should also know that should you decide to go to war, be careful. I've been keeping Tariq mitzvahs. And those two are not a contradiction to each other, because he needs to know that Yaakov is, this is his desired outcome, but this is the outcome for which he is prepared. And on the contrary, one might even say that the second perush of Tariq mitzvah shamarti actually encourages peace. Because if Esav thought that Yaakov would be a walkover and Yaakov would be an easy victory, so then there's no impediment for him going to war. And therefore, why should he choose the path of peace? In other words, Yaakov showing that he's ready for war will actually encourage Esav to think, well, maybe then I should consider the path of peace. And therefore, the two actually, even on a straightforward level, really do go together. Messages are often not binary in nature, but somewhat more complex and composite. And the truth is, there are many people that if you only offer them a message of peace without any indication that you're prepared for war, so you're asking for war. And because the message is, I'm an easy target. And as we know, what doesn't need to elaborate. But interestingly, according to some Mefarshim, this is really what's behind moving ahead a few weeks, but you see how all these ideas come together. The famous notion of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. And somehow, you have all these makos and his heart is hardened. But what is hardening his heart? Is it a supernatural thing? Well, some Mefarshim say that it's actually a very natural thing. Because we see that the first message to Paro was to warn him about the death of his firstborn. That is in the first message to Paro. And of course, Makas Bechoros was lost, which means presumably the worst was saved for last. But it was mentioned first. And this is how Paro's heart was hardened. Because having threatened with the worst, with a level of 10, so in the mindset of Paro, well, why wouldn't you do 10 straight away? In other words, if he's really capable of inflicting such damage, there's in Paro's mindset, there's only one reason why you'd threaten something and not do it. Namely, you can't. Because the other alternative, which is to give the other side a chance and to give them some quarter, is inconceivable. So the irony of the hardening of Paro's heart is that he thought that Hashem was relating to him the way he would relate to other people. If you can, you do. The most damage you can inflict, you do straight away. You don't give them a chance and start with other measures. And therefore, having heard Makas Bechoros, but experiencing only relatively lesser things, Paro says, there's something lacking here. He's not as potent as he claims to be, because if I could do it, I would have done it already. So Paro saw himself in Moshe, and that was his undoing. And the same is true for Esav, that he hears Yaakov, but he shouldn't hear on Esav terms, as if to say, I want peace, as if to say, well, if you want peace, it means you're not capable of war, so that means I'm going to go to war. That's the Levush HaOra. A rather different approach is to be found in the Gur Ari. And he opens with a very maybe disturbing question, even, with regards to Rashi's first Perush. Again, to summarize, what is Rashi saying? Remember the time, says Yaakov, when our father blessed us, that, blessed me more correctly, that Tevigiber la'achecha, and in the end, it didn't happen. So no need to hate me. Now, one can do a lot for the sake of peace, but this seems to be almost denigrating the brachos of Yitzchak. As if to say, you know why you were angry and I ran away? Because we both took the brachos of Yitzhak seriously. We thought they'd really happen. But in the event, they didn't. So I guess no harm done. And if we only knew that the brachos wouldn't really work anyway, so then none of this would have happened. But that seems to be a zilzal of sorts in the brachos of Yitzhak themselves. I mean, how can Yaakov do that? That's quite a liberty, even for the sake of peace. But that's why the Maharal says, and this actually really ties back to the Maharal's comments on the brachos of Yitzhak themselves. V'yitenecha Elokim, mitala shamayim, u'mishmane ha'aretz. And Rashi has a very interesting comment there. Rashi quotes the Medrash a lot, but it's only once in a while that he just refers you to the Medrash, but doesn't really say what the Medrash says. And that's what Rashi does on mitala shamayim, u'mishmane ha'aretz. What does it mean? Says Rashi, the dew of the heavens, the fat of the land, kamashmo, like it sounds. And then says Rashi, umidrashe agada yesh l'harbe panim. And there's many, many interpretations in the Medrash. Well, that's interesting. But the question is, am I learning Rashi or am I learning Medrash? If I'm learning Medrash, I'll find many interpretations of many things. But Rashi, if he will choose an interpretation, so he'll say, Medrash Agada, such and such. But just to tell me, Rashi says that firstly it's Kamashmo. That's all I'm really going to tell you, that it's what it sounds like, the dew of the heavens, fat of the earth. You may, if you're interested, says Rashi, there's many, many interpretations in the Medrash, you can look there. And I am interested, but why is Rashi directing me there? But the Maharal says, if you do look at the Medrash, you will see that the additional interpretations are of a much more inner nature. They're symbolic. their concepts, their spiritual concepts. What is the dew of the heavens? It refers to such and such. And the fat of the earth refers to such and such. And what's Rashi's intention? Says Rashi, I'm not going to tell you everything the Medrash says, but you should look at the Medrash. Because if you do, you'll see there's many layers to this blessing. The primary layer doesn't go away. Kimashma'o. It really sounds like the fat of the land and the dew of the heavens. But there's many additional layers. And why does Rashi want us to know that? Says Maharal, because you've got to understand why Rivka was so keen that Yaakov should get the brachos. If it's just about a good harvest, I mean, that's a lot of trouble caused over something which is very temporal, something which is very physical. And that's where Rashi says, beyond the surface level, there's many, many other qualities that are contained within this blessing. And that's really what Rivka wants. So now, when Yaakov comes back to Esav, how can he appease Esav's anger with regards to the brachos without denigrating them and saying that they didn't work? But Yaakov's point is, the brachos did work. But they didn't work in the way that you probably thought they would work. They worked in a way that's of no interest to you. In other words, Hevi Gevir La'achecha, for example. And he goes on to talk about Shor B'chamor, which is neither Tal HaShamayim or Mishmane Ha'aretz. What Yaakov means to say is, I received the blessings, but none of the literal interpretations or physical interpretations came true with regards to me. What must we conclude? That it was really the spiritual content of the blessing that was given to me. And if that's true, and we've already established that spiritual matters are of not great interest to you, if that's the nature of the blessing, so then it shouldn't be a point of contention. In other words, according to the Maharal, the two comments of Rashi on Garti go together. Because the first, he says, is the bracha was not fulfilled with me in physical sense, because I was a ger, never a kavir. But at the same time, I've done outstandingly well in spiritual terms. I've kept up tariq mitzvahs, even in that Lavan's house. He's a Russia, I didn't learn from him. Where did I get that koach from? From the brachos. In other words, this was the fulfillment of the brachos. Taryag. But you're not interested in taryag. But if it's clear from my experience that that's what the primary fulfillment of the brachos was in spiritual terms, says Yaakov to Esav, therefore there's no need for ill will. And thus is Yaakov able to at least try and appease Esav's anger vis-a-vis the brachos without denigrating them, without nullifying them, but rather by reinterpreting them to brachos that are only of interest to Yaakov, not to Esav. So these are some of the classic comments on this well-known Rashi, the two Perushim of Garti. Well, as we know, Yaakov's meeting with Esav was not the only confrontation that he had in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. There is also the very cryptic confrontation with the Malach, and that is towards the end of Perek Lamed Beis, and it starts equally mystifyingly in Pasuk Kaf Hei. So Vayivasa Yaakov Levado, Yaakov remains by himself. And Rashi, again, famously comments, Shachach Pachim Ketanim. What's he by himself for? He forgot some small things, small jars, V'chazar Alehem. Why does Rashi say this? How do we know this? Rashi sources the Medrash, but the Pasuk just says he's by himself. The Pasuk doesn't say why. Why would Rashi feel that he needs to say why? And how does he know why? Well, I think the simple understanding is that he must have been there for a reason. The prior pasuk says he's moved everything over the brook, right, over everything over the nachal, vayaver es asher lo, and he moves that which was his. So it sounds like he's moved his things. Now the pasuk doesn't say that he vayaver es kol asher lo, everything, but it does say that he moved his things. The implication is that in principle he's really moved his things already, but just not everything. So what must be left? Something that isn't really anything. In other words, things of very little value, so that it's correct to say that he's moved his things already and still have something left. So it must be something of small value. That, I think, is the classical understanding of where we see Pachim Ketanim here. I think perhaps there is another idea here. The Ksava Kabbalah, in a number of places, discusses the two terms that we have in Lashon HaKodesh for things to be left over, or for a person to be left over. You have the term Nish'ar, and you have the term Nosar. And they both mean left over. I wonder if in an English translation there'll be any difference between them. If something is Nish'ar, it's left, remains. If something is Nosar, it's left, it remains. But they are two different words. What's the difference in connotation between Nish'ar and Nosar? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, and as is his wont, he strolls throughout the Tanakh to bring examples for this. There's two ways that something can be left over, or there's two ways that something can be when it's left over. It's either left over in a way that it has poor quality. In other words, it's what we would call leftovers, which is of lesser quality than that which was originally taken. Or perhaps it's left because it's almost like the best for last. And there's two ways that something can remain. And we find both. And this is the difference between Nish'ar and Nosar. Nish'ar means it remains, but it's the more important thing that remains, or as important. Nosar means there's been a diminishing somehow of status, and that's why it's left over. What is, just for illustrative purposes, an example of each. When a person brings a mincha, so as we know, the kometz, a fistful, is taken, and that goes on the mizbeach. And that is the most consecrated part of the korban. That achieves the greatest sanctity. What's the rest called? Vahanoseres. Vahanoseres min ha-mincha, because it's nosar. It's left over in that way. An example of nish'ar is the Mabul. Everyone was destroyed, except for Noah. Vayisha'er ach Noah. So Noah remained. Noah wasn't the leftovers of the Dor HaMabul. He was the only one who was okay. So he remains because he was the best of them. And that's called Nish'ar. So coming back to our pasuk, we find something very interesting. Yaakov moves everything, and then Vayivoser Yaakov Levado. What does that mean? That means that Yaakov is of the least stature of his entire family. It can't be. But the word Vayivaser is used. Nosar always has a connotation of something of diminished value. And perhaps that is why Chazal said, Yaakov is not of diminished value. But the reason why he went back is for things of diminished value. Pachim Ketanim. They were the Nosar, because the important things had already been handed over. Okay. Either way, Yaakov remains. He has the struggle. And in the end, you find in Pasuk Kaftes, whatever the measure and the nature of the struggle, he then insists on a bracha. And that's how we know that this is not a normal fight, even in Pshuta Shomikra. The Pasuk doesn't say who this Ish was. But if the Pasuk does tell us that when Yaakov defeated him and he wants to leave and Yaakov asks for a bracha, this is not a highwayman. I mean, this is someone who's capable of giving brachas that are of significance. And as we know, the bracha takes the form of a name change. Vayoma Elav Mashemecha, what's your name? Vayoma Yaakov, hey, my name is Yaakov. And then says the Malach, Vayomer lo Yaakov yame ochimcha. Your name will no longer be said to be Yaakov, ki im Yisrael. You will henceforth be known as Yisrael. Ki sarisa im Elohim v'manashim v'tuchal. You've struggled with angels, you've struggled with people, you've prevailed, and therefore you are Yisrael. So that's quite a bracha, as things go. Most brachas, I don't think, involve new names. But this one did. And as we know, it's actually a forerunner for Hashem himself changing the name, which takes place if we take a look in the end of our parsha, in Perek Lamed He, Pasuk Yud. Perek Lamed He, Pasuk Yud. Much has happened, of course, but we're just focusing on these two poles. Vayomer lo Elokim Shimcha Yaakov. Hashem says to Yaakov, your name is Yaakov. Lo yikore Shimcha od Yaakov. You will no longer be called Yaakov. Ki im Yisrael Yeshemecha. Your name will be Yisrael. Vayikra Hashem od Yisrael. So it actually seems to be more wordy. Your name is Yaakov, but it won't be Yaakov. It will be Yisrael. And he called him Yisrael. Okay. So if we try and look a little more closely at these two psukim, because it is a very interesting situation, where do we find that a person receives a new name from two entities and two such distinct and disparate entities? One is the Malach of Esav, and he says he's Yisrael, and then Hashem himself says he's Yisrael. What's the point of both of them changing? Secondly, Hashem's change, which we just read in Lamed Hey Yud, it's almost seems to be a contradiction. Because Hashem says to him, Shimcha Yaakov, your name is Yaakov. But your name won't be Yaakov anymore. So then why did you say that his name is Yaakov? When the Malach said to him, so he asked him, what's your name? So Yaakov says, my name is Yaakov. And the Malach said, well, it's not anymore. So he's changed from Yaakov to Yisrael. But in Pasuk Yud of Lamed Hey, it's all coming from Hashem. And he starts by affirming that his name is Yaakov and then changing it. So why affirm it and no need to change it? And a very interesting further nuanced difference between these two. And here it takes the greats to notice these things. Of course, once they do, it's completely obvious, as is often the case. The malach, the verb that indicates the change, changes. Because if we go back to the first pasuk, so the malach says in pasuk kaftes, vayomer lo Yaakov ye'amer ot shimcha. So the word is ye'amer. What does ye'amer mean? To say. And what does it mean? Your name will no longer be said to be Yaakov, which we translate as, because you won't be called Yaakov. But when Hashem says, lo yikare shimcha od Yaakov, you will no longer be called Yaakov. So the Malach uses lo yi'amer, and Hashem uses lo yikare. What is the difference between those two terms? And these questions are discussed in the drushes of the Aruch Laner. The Aruch Laner, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, one of the great German rabbis of the 1800s, in fact, one of the teachers of Rav Hirsch, and he's famous, he's called the Aruch Laner over his works on the Masechtas, but his drushes on the Torah is called Minchas Oni, and he says quite a chiddush. Earlier in the parasha, the Malach changes his name from Yaakov to Yisrael. Subsequently, Hashem changes his name from Yaakov to Yisrael. We look upon this as Hashem endorsing the change, underwriting, you know, signing off on the change that was originally made by a Malach. Presumably, a Malach, his authority only goes so far. So he says, your name is Yisrael, and Hashem says, yes, your name is Yisrael, confirming that which the Malach said. However, says the Aruch Laner, no. When Hashem changed his name from Yaakov to Yisrael, he was not confirming what Esav's Malach had done. He was undoing what Esav's Malach has done. Esav's Malach is always Esav's Malach. In other words, we might be inclined to look upon this as like a wonderful moment where Esav's spiritual overseer sees the light and finally comes round and sees that Yaakov has been right all along. A special time, what they used to call a Kodak moment, where that's one moment he breaks character, and he says, Yaakov, you're really right. Not so. Until further notice, says the Aruch Laner, he's Esav's Malach. So what's it all about? Well, what's the name change all about? I mean, from Avram to Avram, we can understand. Whatever that means, Avla Aram, Avamon Goy. From Yaakov to Yisrael, what's the difference in connotation? Well, as we know, Yisrael, and you can see as it's described in this pasuk, Yisrael really represents Yaakov at his best. It's a level that he graduated into. Yaakov is when he's born, with all of its connotations. But Yisrael, kisarisa, you've contended, you've struggled with an angel, with man, and you've prevailed. And in a sense, therefore, Yaakov has been promoted, shall we say. He's graduated into this name, which is great for Yaakov. However, it is not great for others. Who is it not great for? Well, as we know, the Jewish people themselves undergo a change with Yaakov. Because as of Yaakov, everyone is in the program. Anyone who's born Jewish is in the program, regardless of what happens. And that was a development. With Avram was not that way. Of all of his children, only Yitzhak continues. The others fell by the wayside. They're not in the program at all. And Yitzhak's two sons likewise. Only Yaakov, not Esav at all. But now, Yaakov has 12 sons, and they're all part of the program, as are their descendants. That's the consolidation of Jewish identity that was introduced with Yaakov. And therefore, no one falls by the wayside. Everyone is contained within Jewish identity and all that goes with that. Now, some of them operate on a higher level than others. That is true. And it's for that very reason that the Jewish people themselves are sometimes referred to as Yaakov, and on other times referred to as Yisrael. And moreover, within the Jewish people, there are some who are referred to as Yaakov and some Yisrael. We find with Bilam the whole time, he keeps on going back from Batova Olecha Yaakov, Mishkanosecha Yisrael, and so on and so forth. Darachkochav mi Yaakov, Vekam Shevet mi Yisrael. Yaakov and Yisrael is an ongoing duality, because you have those who are of the Jewish people who are on a higher level, and those who are on a lower level. But they're all in. And now, says the Aruch Laner, imagine that Yaakov had shifted up into Yisrael and jettisoned the name Yaakov completely. For him, it's fantastic. For his descendants, who are on a level, who are capable of answering to the level called Yisrael, fantastic. But for those who are only on the level of Yaakov, they're shut out because they don't have a father anymore, because there is no Yaakov. He's changed. Yaakov doesn't live here anymore. Yisrael lives here now. And if you're Yaakov, well, that's too bad. And it will be another generation of people falling by the wayside. But that didn't happen. And that's in a sense, the sting in the tail. The curse within the blessing of Esav's angel. Because he wants that change to take place straight away. And who suffers? The Jewish people, the strata of the Jewish people that are called Yaakov. But it's not so. In fact, Pachad Yitzhak says, it's very interesting that we never find that Avram and Yitzhak had these struggles. And certainly we never find that they sustained damage. Here's Yaakov, and he has the struggle. And he emerges victorious, generally, as per the admission of the Malach, but not completely. That Teker Kafirech Yaakov, he sustains damage in his thigh. And what does that mean? What it means? So why should? But he's the greatest of the Avos. In other words, the culmination of all of the efforts of the Avos. He's known as Bechir Sheba Avos. How should the one with the highest achievements, building on the first two generations' achievements, be the only one to sustain damage? Because he's carrying more. In other words, Avram and Yitzhak, they don't carry the ones who are not making the grade. So there's no reason for them to sustain damage. They succeed completely, and they are patriarchs for those who succeed completely. But Yaakov is a patriarch for everyone, but not all of them are on the desired level. So he sustains damage. And of course, the thigh represents his progeny. And this brings us to the difference in meaning between the word amira and kriya, lo ye amer and lo ye kare. What's the difference between them? Well, as we know, we translate. Omer means to say, kare means to call. Says the Aruch Laner, when do you call someone and when do you say something to them? You call them when they're far away, and then when they come close to you, you speak with them. In other words, the term kriya, calling, has a connotation of distance. Amira has a connotation of proximity. Now, when you talk about the future, if you map those two terms and just shift space into time, then kriya, which is about distance, is in the distant future. Amira, which is about proximity, is in the near future. And this is the difference between the bracha, quote-unquote, of Esav's malach and that of Hashem. Because Esav's malach says, you said your name is Yaakov? No. Lo ye amer ot shimcha Yaakov. Amira, meaning sometime in the future and soon in the future, the sooner the better, as far as Esav is concerned, you will become Yisrael and no longer Yaakov. Why? Because then all of your descendants who could only really be called Yaakov, you're not there for them anymore. And that's why when Hashem subsequently appears to Yaakov and talks about this topic, the very first thing he says is, I'm telling you, your name is Yaakov. Until further notice, you are Yaakov. Shimcha Yaakov, that's the first thing. And it's not going away anytime soon. Why? Because you will have descendants who need you to be Yaakov. Because they're Yaakov type people. Relative. Now it is true, you have attained a higher level. And there will be a transition. At a certain point, you will no longer be Yaakov. You know when? When no one needs you to be Yaakov. When all of your descendants will be on the level called Yisrael. Okay. You know when that's going to be? Not anytime soon. And that's why when Hashem phrases the transition, he uses the expression lo yikarei, which denotes distance. In the distant future, you will no longer be called Yaakov, only Yisrael. The pasuk concludes, Vayikra Hashemo Yisrael, you already are Yisrael. But you haven't stopped being Yaakov. Those are all of the parts of what Hashem is saying. And with that in mind, he actually reversed the machinations or the plan of Esav's angel to have the transition to take place as soon as possible. Very, very interesting explanation. And again, it's so easy and understandable for us to look at these two episodes as being just one endorsing the other, to understand that one is really the reversal of the other. And then Rav Ettlinger signs off with what my father used to call a rabbinic PS. And that is, you know, there's a pasuk in Malachi, I think it's in the Haftarah for Shabbos HaGadol, Malachi Perek Gimel. And there it's a well-known pasuk. It says, Ki ani Hashem lo shanisi. Vatem b'nei Yaakov lo chelisem. That's the pasuk. Ani Hashem lo shanisi. I am Hashem. I have not changed. Vatem b'nei Yaakov lo chelisem. And you, sons of Yaakov, you haven't been lost. You haven't been destroyed. What does that mean? Well, and why are they called b'nei Yaakov and not Yisrael? Not b'nei Yisrael, which is more the norm. Says the Aruch Laner. How does the pasuk begin? Ki ani Hashem. Whenever we have an expression, Ani Hashem, we know from the Haggadah Shal Pesach. What's the connotation of Ani Hashem? Ani velo malach, right? Ani Hashem, Ani velo malach, Ani velo sarf, Ani velo shlech, meaning Ani Hashem is me as opposed to someone else. So Ani Hashem lo shanisi means I Hashem didn't change, meaning as opposed to the malach who did change. Ani velo malach, the malach wanted to effect a change in you straight away, but I didn't allow it. Ani Hashem velo malach, Lo shanisi. And who are the benefactors? Who benefits from this? B'nai Yaakov. Because if I'd allowed the change, B'nai Yaakov would have been destroyed. They have no avlef. But because Ani Hashem lo shanisi, atem B'nai Yaakov lo chelisem. B'nai Yaakov are in the picture as long as they need Yaakov to be their father. So very wonderful explanations of these historic psukim. The episode of Dina and Shechem, which is very, very difficult, we've discussed it in the past, in terms of the brothers response, as if to say, what did they do? How can it be explained? Rambam and Ramban and many others to wipe out the city. It was certainly the topic of much discussion. At this juncture, though, I'd like to take a look at the way that they hear the news. And that's in Perek Lamed Dalet Pasuk Zayin. Very interesting expression in the pasuk. Uvnei Yaakov ba'u min ha'sadeh kisham'am. The perek, again, Perek Lamed Dalet Pasuk Zayin. They come from the field when they hear. Vayis'atzvu ha'anashim. They're very terribly upset. Vayichlemet, I'm very angry. Why? Ki nevala asa b'Yisrael. Because he, Shechem, did this terrible disgrace in Yisrael, Lishkav of Espas Yaakov, to deal with Dina that way, a daughter of Yaakov, V'chein lo yaseh, and so it shall not be done. V'chein lo yaseh. So it's a very interesting, in a sense, signing off of the pasuk. He did this terrible thing, and that sort of thing shouldn't be done. That's really what it sounds like. V'chein lo yaseh. But what are those words adding? And a very interesting interpretation, which contains a lot in it, came out from a story that occurred with the Beis Halevi, the first of the Soloveitchiks. And in fact, my Rebbe, Rosh Hashiva, Baruch Mordechai Ezrachi Shalita, actually, he tells this story every year. I mean, I haven't heard in recent years, but from what I know, it's a yearly thing, Parshas Vayishlach, the story of the Beis Halevi. And what's the background? The Beis Halevi, he was the Rav in Brisk, first in Slutsk, and then in Brisk. And he had an interesting nohag. And that was that he had the rabbinic garb, but when he would travel out of town, he wouldn't wear it. He would just dress like everybody else. He'd look like a nice elderly Jew. But you couldn't tell by looking at him that he was a rabbi, unless you knew him, which many people did. But if you didn't, you wouldn't. And it was a certain shitta. It was a certain, just to keep the rabbinic garb in its place. And if he's not where he needs it, so then he doesn't need it. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, his son, likewise, would travel that way. There's all sorts of things that happened as a result of that. But regardless, and therefore. On a certain occasion, so he comes to a tavern. He's looking to find lodgings, and the owner of the tavern, who was not particularly well disposed towards this, you know, some elderly Jewish figure who comes in, even though he was Jewish, but he didn't give him much consideration, and in fact, he really dealt with him in a way that was not appropriate at all. Didn't take care of him and just put him somewhere in some. Made him wait, and all. It really didn't give him much good service. Okay, as far as he's concerned, business is business, and this doesn't look like a particularly high caliber customer, and so on and so forth. Everything changed, of course, when other people started to come into the tavern who knew who this person was. He was the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, and then became the Rav of Slutsk, and then of Brisk. These were his Tamidim, these were his admirers. And when word got out, and it reached the ears of the tavern keeper that the guest that he'd abused and ignored was none other than the Beis Halevi of Brisk, so as we can appreciate, he was somewhat mortified. And he hurries, he makes his way to the Beis Halevi and says, I don't know what to say. I need to ask the Rav for Mechila. And the Beis Halevi said, no, you don't. So that was easy. He was getting ready for a bit of a humble pie. But then the Beis Halevi says, you don't need to ask the Rav for Mechila. So he says, oh, so I just don't need to ask for Mechila? Says the Beis Halevi, you do need to ask for Mechila. You just don't need to ask the Rav for Mechila. So that was a little bit confusing for this tavern keeper. He is in the tavern business after all, not in the diuk business. But so the Beis Halevi says, I'd like to explain to you. And he opened up the Chumash. Bring us the Chumash. He opened the Parshas Vayishlach. If you look in Vayishlach, you'll see something very interesting. And really, the more you ponder it, the more depth you see in what the Beis Halevi is about to say. Here you have Shechem and Dinah. He did these terrible things to her. And she's in a terrible situation. And the brothers are, they're upset and they're angry. And why are they angry? So it seems no explanation, but the Pasuk actually provides two explanations. The first thing it says is, Ki nevala asa b'Yisrael. To have done something like that to Yisrael, Lishkav is Bas Yaakov, the daughter of Yaakov, it's horrific. And then the Pasuk says, adds these words, V'chein lo yaseh. And that shouldn't be done. What does that add? I think we've said everything with the earlier phrase. What are these three words, V'chein lo yaseh? Says the Beis Halevi, you can understand that the brothers are particularly outraged by the fact that this has happened in their family. And that's noted. The Pasuk says, Nevala asa b'Yisrael. Lishkav is Bas Yaakov. For this to happen to them, clearly they take particular exception to it. And that's where the Pasuk mentions it. However, the Pasuk doesn't leave it there, because you might get the impression that, so what's the subtotal of Shechem's wrongdoing? That's not the sort of thing that you should do with a Jewish girl. Or that's not the sort of way that you should treat the daughter of Yaakov. One may have understood that that's where they were angry. To us, implying, if it was someone else, it's not such a problem. If that's not true. In other words, they particularly were upset because it's them, and because it's Bas Yaakov, etc. But the Pasuk says, don't seem to think that it was someone else, it would be acceptable. It's never acceptable. V'chein lo yaseh. That shouldn't happen to anyone, whoever they are. Whether they're from Bas Yisrael, Bas Yaakov, whoever they are. No one should have to undergo that. That shouldn't go unsaid. And that's the duality of what's happening here. Lemaisa happened to Yisrael, which is particularly horrific. But if it happened to anyone, it's horrific. V'chein lo yaseh, it shouldn't happen anywhere. Says the Beis Halevi, gently translating this into his situation. Before you knew I was a Rav, and I just looked like a normal person, just like an elderly Jew, you really treated me in an incorrect manner at all. Why? Because you thought I was just a Jew, and what difference does it make? When you found out I was a Rav, so all of a sudden you're full of respect. So you say that you have to ask the Rav for Mechila, but it's not true, because from the moment you found out I was the Rav, you were full of respect. So your relationship with the Rav is fine, but your relationship with Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, that's what needs to be addressed here. Because the way that you treated me isn't the way that one shouldn't treat a Rav. It's the way one shouldn't treat anyone. Just like it says, V'chein lo yaseh. And therefore be sure that when other people come, and most people that come through your tavern will not be rabbis, but the way you treated me before you knew I was a rabbi is the way that no one should be treated. Be sure to bear that in mind. So it's very interesting from everything else that's going on in the story of Dinah and Shechem, that perspective that is communicated by this story. So let's just conclude by the birth of Binyamin, which is very interesting, and that is in Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Yud Ches. And again, the psukim and the content certainly are well known to us, but to try and get a deeper understanding here. So this is Rachel, and she enters a childbirth, and she's in a critical situation. And as it happens, she dies in childbirth, giving birth to Binyamin. Peruk lamed hei pasuk yud ches. And then, it says, "Vayi b'tzeis nafsha," as her soul is leaving her, kibesa, because she was dying. Vatikroshimo, she calls him Ben Oni, the son of my travail. And then says the pasuk, "Va'aviv karalo Binyamin," and his father called him Binyamin. And from that point onwards, he's Binyamin. No one ever calls him Ben-Oni. She called him Ben-Oni, but his father called him Binyamin, and that's how it stayed. And of course, when we only stop and ponder, it really needs explanation, as if to say. This is almost like her dying will. These are her last words. How can it possibly be acceptable? I mean, we have to ask the question correctly, but we have to ask the question. She says Ben-Oni, and that's it. She's no longer alive. And Yaakov says, "I don't think it should be called Ben-Oni. I think it should be called Binyamin." How can he do that? That seems to be contravening what clearly is what she wanted him to be called. And it seems to be even a denigration of her final wishes. But once again, the Aruch Laner explains that no, it's not true. Actually, by changing his name, Yaakov was giving honor to Rachel. Her name was the denigrating name. Now what does that mean? The background to Rachel's death at this point, and there's many explanations, obviously, it's a very, very difficult topic. But as we know, the Ramban famously says that the whole concept of the avos keeping tariag outside of Chutz La'aretz is keeping tariag before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah, the 613 mitzvahs, before they were commanded, is specifically in Eretz Yisrael, not in Chutz La'aretz. Those are his words as stated. There was no actual obligation to keep them, but they understood that in the land of Israel, you always need to keep Tariq mitzvahs, whether you've been commanded or not. And that's why, says Ramban, one of the 613 mitzvahs, one of the 365 negative prohibitions, is to marry two sisters when they are both yet alive. But Yaakov did it. But how could he do it? Because he was not in Eretz Yisrael. But what that did mean, and this was known to them, what that did mean is when the time came and they would go back to the land of Israel, both of those sisters could not remain. And Rachel was married second. And in fact, this is, according to some Mefarshim, is why it's actually Rachel that answers first. When Yaakov speaks to them and says it's time to go back, Vatan Rachel v'Leah. Rachel answers first. From a certain point of view, Leah can't answer. Because Rachel is the one whose life is at stake here. She needs to be the one to initiate the response to say, if it's time to go back, it's time to go back. And whatever will happen, will happen. And then it happened. The thing is, what is the difference between, in connotation, between Ben-Oni and Ben-Yamin? Ben-Yamin means born in Eretz Yisrael. Rashi says that Yamin is to the south, meaning one is always facing east. So left and right is north and south. So Ben-Yamin is to the south because the land of Israel is to the south of Haran as one travels. And therefore Ben-Yamin is born in the land of Israel. That's what Ben-Yamin means. Now why would Yaakov change her name? Because here she is in a place which is called, or at a juncture which is called Kivras Eretz, a certain distance away from Ephras. In other words, it's not clear whether or not they're already in the land of Israel or not. Even Rashi says that later on Yaakov will say to Yosef, "You may have tainus on me. You may have complaints against me that I buried your mother in Chutz La'aretz." In other words, The borders were not yet clear to know what's Eretz Yisrael, what's Chutz La'aretz, and therefore we happen to know that it's in Eretz Yisrael. And Yaakov doesn't want Yosef to think otherwise. But what difference does it make? Because if she is dying in childbirth, and she's not yet even back in the land of Israel, there must be another reason. And she feels that she's at fault. Aven is wrongdoing. The travail of Aven is wrongdoing. She says, and this is her an almost admission, that she must have done something wrong herself. Because she doesn't know if she's in the land of Israel. And if she isn't, and still this is happening to her, this must be the child of my wrongdoing. And that's why Yaakov changes the name. Nothing, she didn't do anything wrong. This is not the child. Why did this happen? Because he's Benjamin. He's buried. He's born in the land of Israel. And what had to happen, happened. They were already in Eretz Yisrael. And this is a perspective on something which is otherwise almost incomprehensible that Yaakov would change the name that she gave, but she gave the name in a way that indicted herself, and Yaakov is changing the name to a way which fully exonerates her and only holds her in the highest light, which of course we know to be the case. Much food for thought there. We'll leave it over there for this evening.